On this episode of The Flophouse, we discuss Wild Hogs. It's like City Slickers with twice as much leather. Hey everyone, welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Elliot Kalin.
I'm Rich Duncan.
Yes, Elliot has returned from his exodus covering the conventions with The Daily Show.
Mm-hmm.
However, Stuart now is gone. Apparently we cannot have all three of us in the same room
The new
anymore.
Flophouse rule that there cannot be all three Flophouseians in one place at the one time.
What is this bitter feud that you have with Stuart, Elliot?
Stuart's a great guy. It's not my fault if he refuses to be seen with me. You know, he's just wearing his scorpion belt buckle somewhere else right now.
He does have a very large belt buckle that has a scorpion in it.
And it's
when
awesome.
I say a scorpion, we mean one that used to be alive, like a real scorpion.
An actual scorpion.
In like a glass bubble.
Imagine there was a scorpion paperweight, and then imagine that paperweight
was on a belt. I mean, I'm sure, Stuart, I'm sure would feel like he missed nothing from this movie since there was no female nudity.
And
it was terrible, and nothing blew up. No, actually, that's not true. There was one explosion.
This is my second time I've been on the...
Yeah, we should briefly reintroduce Rich to the Flophouse audience. Rich was with us for Good Luck Chuck.
Oh, right. I blocked that out.
He was the editor of Jest Magazine.
You only get the bad comedies.
He's a stand-up. He's currently writing a comedic book about werewolves.
Yes.
And yeah, he apparently is the guy we call when we're going to watch a comedy, which is a bad thing because, as you probably know, if you're a bad movie aficionado, a bad horror film or a sci-fi or a thriller... often very funny. Bad comedy is usually painful.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is you see, it works both ways, where a bad horror movie will change into a good comedy, because you have the same tension and release in horror and comedy. It's very similar the way those two film genres work. However, when you are expecting a comedy and it goes backwards and it turns into horrible, then it's you didn't want horror, and it's horrifying.
Pardon me while I belch. Yeah, no.
It's a regular Algonquin roundtable here at the Flophouse.
Yeah.
Have another witty bon mot there, Dan.
Shut up.
But what movie did we watch today, Mr. McCoy?
We watched Wild Hogs, a star-studded vehicle.
This is one of the most star-studded movies we've seen.
Yeah.
With, I think, one star in it that I think we can all agree we like, and mm-hmm. others that we don't.
We may have
mixed opinions on.
Let's announce the four stars, and then you... the podcast listener in your brain can guess who we liked, and then we will reveal it. So this movie starred Tim Allen,
John Travolta,
Martin Lawrence, and William H. Macy. So take a moment to ponder.
what are we pondering again?
Who out of the four of them, who we thought was passable in this film?
Okay.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of smaller parts also played by stars.
Yeah, there was
Ray Liotta.
Marissa Tomei.
The Sklar brothers. I don't know if those are
brothers.
Those are stars to us.
Yeah,
maybe
twin comedians, very funny stand-ups.
Ned Ryerson from Groundhog Day.
Yeah, Toblerowski, the actor's name.
The dude from Scrubs.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
John C. McGinley.
Yeah.
Yeah, KG from Tenacious D. In an all-singing
a galaxy of stars.
A galaxy of. As I was saying, we were watching it. It seemed like there was the regular director who wanted to make a shitty movie, and then like an assistant director who was like, "I'll just hire a lot of comedy people.
Let's get some cult figures in here."
Yeah.
Hey, KG from Tenacious D.
Why don't you show up as a guy who just sings in shots that are completely unrelated to the rest of what's going on?
Sort
in the
of like gay Western disco. That'd be funny.
It stood in contrast to the other gay jokes, though. This was packed with gay jokes, and then there was one other gay joke that seemed to rise above the rest.
Yeah, well, as you said, Rich, this movie was a lot of montages of motorcycling through the country.
Yep.
Motorcycling, that's the verb, right? Motorcycling?
Yeah, motorcycling.
And in between, there was a lot of gay panic humor.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, I don't know why...
I saw that movie, Gay Panic. So in the 60s where the terrorists were going to set off the gay bomb, it was going to turn everybody gay. There was a panic, and then Walter Matthau and Bruce Dern were able to discover its location.
Ernest Borgnine was terrifying.
As the leader of the gay terrorists.
The taking of Gay Panic 1, 2, 3.
Ernest Borgnine in all pink. But that was the sort of level of homosexual humor you could expect.
Well, you can understand the movie about four guys who are vaguely dissatisfied with their middle-aged life, who take a motorcycle trip cross country wearing leather and are caught in a series of situations that imply that they're gay.
And then they vociferously doesn't deny their gayness. And honestly,
but the movie takes a bizarre left turn when they piss off some bikers and get punched in the face like a million times.
I think that this movie would make a lot more sense if you read it for subtext and you just believed that these are actually four gay men who are coming to terms with their sexuality, and to that end they take a trip across country.
But yeah, I could see that.
Well, similar to my theory that Jaws 2 would be a better movie if there was no shark in it, and it was just it was just Roy Scheider, you know, insisting that there was a shark this time, and it was post-traumatic stress disorder the entire time, and it turned out there was no shark.
So a curse of the cat people to Jaws. The first Jaws is cat people. Yeah. There's no actual cat people in the second movie.
I didn't know that.
It's just about a little girl's overactive imagination.
That's exactly what Jaws 2 should have been. Well, we're getting off topic from Wild Hogs,
I think we'll get off topic. We'll circle back. Yeah.
I think that you know, if these guys actually were gay men the entire time, and that they had been engaging in gay sex acts that would then be revealed in a big flashback. Although all I'm doing is getting around to the idea of this is how Wild Hogs would be better. And an exercise of
so many.
If William H. Macy were to catch fire and die, that would make it, you know.
Well, there are occasional jokes where they went very big in terms of crazy things happening, like John Travolta being hit in the face by a raven while he was driving his motorcycle, where it was like, oh, somebody had a sense of humor who worked on this. But otherwise, it was a lot of, you know, and so forth.
But without the funny sound effects.
Yeah. I was kind of wondering, before we started recording, do you think the screenplay of Wild Hogs was written and then these guys read it and were like, I got to be in this project? Or Disney or whoever made it said, listen, we have Tim Allen, John Travolta, Martin Lawrence, and William H. Macy under contract. Someone write an idea. Someone write a movie around these.
I thought for a second that you'd be like, Wild Hogs was floating around. It was like it was like a Shane Black screenplay. Someone had bid millions of dollars for the screenplay. Yeah. This gold screenplay, and they're like, all right, give me a list of four middle-aged actors, three Caucasian, one black, and we're going to put them in a zany road picture comedy.
Or it was the script for Unforgiven, where it had been around for about 20 years, and then finally the right people picked it up, except it was a terrible script as opposed to the one for Unforgiven.
Well, it was a radical comedy experiment where they're like, all right, what if there's four straight men
and no
all
jokes
out on the road? And they're all just constantly setting up a potentially humorous situation.
Well, I think you've reached one of the main problems of the movie, which is that every one of them had the same personality and except for William H. Macy, who was the nerd.
Well, let's start at
the
beginning.
Martin Lawrence, who was the vaguely black guy.
He also couldn't stand up to women, which would have been easier to ascertain if there were any women in the film that he could not stand up to.
There was the one woman he glanced at earlier in the film, and then his voice-activated Mac laptop misheard him and started looking up very loud porn sites.
Martin Lawrence I'm talking about.
Oh, Martin Lawrence. Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, they showed him being yelled at by his wife while he worked on his how-to book, which they never explained what it was about.
That's right.
Yeah,
His wife goes, listen, I know your how-to book will be a big hit, but you need to start making money. And it's like, what? You can't just say a how-to book and expect
Elliot,
us
to... Elliot, you don't realize America has a real thirst to learn how-to.
I guess you're right. So, I've always wanted to know how-to.
That might have been the through line of truth, though, in the movie, where the person who wrote this was actually attempting to write a how-to book.
And somehow wrote Wild Hogs.
Yes, instead, while procrastinating from writing his how-to book.
How to write a hit.
But did you want to circle back around and do the plot again?
I wanted to start from the beginning so we don't lose the audience, because Wild Hogs has so many ins, so many outs.
It goes Wild Hogs on the levels of complexity. It goes Last Year at Marienbad, Wild Hogs, and then I guess, Woman in the Dunes or El Topo? In terms of complexity and hardness to penetrate.
Yeah. So this movie starts out with there's four guys, you know,
who own motorcycles,
played by your favorite actors.
They do own motorcycles and leather jackets and are part of a motorcycle gang called Wild Hogs.
Yeah, they already have leather jackets with the logo and name on it.
Any film viewer, someone who's seen mainstream Hollywood movies over the past 20 or 30 years.
Let's say 45 years.
Yeah, you might believe that something drives these characters to become a motorcycle gang.
Called the Wild Hogs.
Yeah. No, once we join them, they're already a wimpy motorcycle gang. They're already a suburban motorcycle gang of four, like,
one of whom cannot ride his motorcycle.
So here's the way I would have structured this movie. I would have had these four guys who are friends explain how they became friends, because they're really very, you know, they don't explain
totally
it
different.
Ever. And they're not that, they're similar in that they have no personality, but otherwise they're not similar. Different socioeconomic backgrounds, different ethnic groups and so forth. I would have had them lament how boring their lives are, and then one of them would have seen that four motorcycles were for sale across the street at the motorcycle warehouse, and they come on, guys, let's join a motorcycle gang. We've always wanted to do this, and you
Born
know what?
To Be Wild starts playing.
That, and somehow they see like two signs back, like one says like Wild Animal Park, and then like a hogs truck backs up in front of the sign, and it says Wild Hogs. That should be our name. And then Born to Be Wild starts playing, and they drive off. Like, you would, the inciting event of the movie should be them buying motorcycles and going on a bike trip, but instead
you're forgetting, though, that I think that it should be just the three friends, and then William H. Macy, who's the nerd that they all hate, is just fixing their computer. He sees there's a motorcycle. He joins to be in the gang. Nobody wants that guy.
See, yeah, that would bring a dynamic that doesn't exist.
And well, he like, because of his many hours on the internet, where all information resides, he knows everything about motorcycle repair. So he becomes a valued member of the group.
Instead, what happens is these four friends already own motorcycles. They're already bad at driving them. William H. Macy falls off his all the time in ways that would kill a man, or at least snap his neck in real life.
Or another person.
Yeah,
the motorcycle flies into the street.
No, he's a danger to
everybody.
He's
a hazard.
He should not be riding a motorcycle. No. And they're hanging out together, and they're unhappy that they're not a real motorcycle gang. And then someone drops by with the news that Tom Peterson passed away. A character
Tom Peterson, Elliot?
Tom Peterson.
He was our age.
Tom Peterson, as we learned from the dialogue, was their age and is now dead. He was never mentioned before, and he will never be mentioned again. It's like just a name, but they've conjured up this whole human figure who existed and is dead now, just for the purpose of pushing the plot forward slightly. And there was something insulting to the idea of Tom Peterson in that.
But they didn't even – I mean, they still wanted to go on the trip before Tom Peterson died.
Oh, yeah. They were going to go on the trip before Tom Peterson died.
Pushed Tim Allen over the edge. Like, oh, well, if Tom Peterson died, then
– Oh, man, Tom Peterson. We don't know what his relationship is to Tim Allen.
I guess
we don't
Tom
know how
Peterson
they knew
was
him.
Always talking about taking a trip across country. This is in honor of Tom Peterson.
At the end of
Wild Hogs, there should have been in memoriam Tom Peterson.
But they don't even tell you how he died is the other thing. You just know that he could have died because a safe fell on his head, you know, like – Or because
I think they would have kept that in.
Well, yeah, this is maybe. Also something that I like bothers me.
He committed suicide. Like, I don't know. I know what you're saying.
This is sort of a city slicker setup where it's like these men have sort of like midlife
honks. Let's call them city slickers, for lack of a better term.
These city slickers who have no business being on a motorcycle. They have they're unsatisfied with their lives, but their lives don't seem that bad.
No.
You know, like, the worst of them is John Travolta, who apparently he has this wife who has abandoned him, and he's broke.
Mm-hmm.
And he's obese.
Yeah. And he's John Travolta.
And he's gay and doesn't want to admit it.
Yeah.
He's a closeted gay man.
who's losing his shape and any acting ability once had.
I thought as an actor, though, it was amazing the way he wove into the performance that he was a closeted gay man. The script didn't mention it. It never called for it. But clearly he was a man who was obese and was gay and upset about it. And he brought that to the role, though it didn't seem like it was mentioned in the script at all.
That's your classic method. He's just, you know, using his own experiences to bring the character to life.
What do you mean?
Go.
And let me be clear, although Wild Hogs was a strangely anti-gay movie, this is not an anti-gay podcast. In fact, I felt bad for Travolta, thinking like, if he is in fact a closeted gay man, as has been suggested by the tabloid press, does he feel bad appearing into the film that has so much humor based on the idea of just panicking whenever like someone thinks that you might
be
gay?
Do you remember, if you guys remember that the candy bar commercial where the two guys are eating the candy bar from either end and they accidentally
kiss? It was a Super Bowl commercial.
Yeah. And then they start hitting themselves with wrenches and car batteries because they need to push this gay moment out of their bodies. This movie was kind of like that at times.
Yeah.
Well, the idea of being thought of as gay was so repugnant to them. Although, to be fair, John C. McGinley was coming on to them in a way that made it seem like if they didn't very actively say they weren't gay or come up with a side story, he would have raped them.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that was alarming, but don't let's not get ahead of ourselves.
It does imply also that there are gay cops roaming the countryside looking for men to.
But during the rape scene, there would have been like a tin whistle sound. You know what I mean? It would have been. It was wacky.
I'm just saying, John Travolta, don't hate yourself to appear in Wild Hogs. Don't punish yourself in that way.
If Wild Hogs 2,
the script comes across your desk, turn it down.
Even wilder.
When you bring
Wild Hogs 2, more wild, more hog.
You know, he seems to have moved on. He was in Hairspray playing the divine role. So.
And now he's going to be in Bolts playing a dog. So. Yeah.
But anyway, but he had the worst life, and Martin Lawrence had sort of a bad life in that
his how-to book was going nowhere.
Yeah, his how-to book was going nowhere, and on the side, he was like a janitor who cleaned up shit-filled restrooms
in convenience stores.
So that's not very good.
And his wife was always mad at him, and
there was so much shit in the bathroom that they had to put not one but two strings of police tape.
Yeah, it was a criminal amount of shit.
I mean, it's possible someone might have shat themselves to death. Like, there could be a pile. Maybe they died and evacuated.
It was
on
just
the
like in Ed the Happy Clown.
Yikes.
The Chester Brown comic
that's
strip.
A really obscure reference to make.
Whatever. But I assume he's the guy the police call in when the place is so dirty that it's breaking a law.
But, you know, William H. Macy is clearly just sort of a clumsy dork. That's the worst you could say about him.
Yeah.
And Tim Allen.
With seemingly no experience with women.
Tim Allen is a dentist. Granted, dentist, you know, high suicide rates, but a well-paying job.
Is that true?
That's true. It's a very high suicide rate job. And because of that, it's like movie shorthand for depressed guy.
Yeah.
I guess because you got your hands in someone's mouth all the time.
I mean, it seems like it's not a great line of work. I mean, but Alan Arkin was happy with it. Yeah. In The In-Laws, Alan Arkin was very happy being a dentist.
However, though, Tim Allen, in the medical field, obviously well off, has a beautiful house, has a gorgeous wife in Jill Hennessy.
You're saying they should have made him a proctologist.
Yeah, I'm.
That would have been that much worse.
If they were going to go for a zany medical field, yes. Yeah, why not?
Well, he's unhappy because his son doesn't think he's cool.
Right.
Is that why?
I mean, I'm going to turn 27 in a couple months. I assume that.
Your son doesn't think
you're cool. I don't have a child, but when I have a child someday, I could be a rock star astronaut who has a dinosaur that he rides to work, and I assume my son will still find me uncool. That's just what being a dad means.
But apparently it creates so much distress in him that he has to drop everything.
This is an audio podcast, but I would like to bring up the point that Elliot made that point while wearing a shirt of a vampire riding a dinosaur
true.
To work.
That's a coincidence. Yeah. That's just a coincidence.
I didn't even notice that. Aren't there UFOs in that shirt, too?
Yeah, well, this is...
And zombies?
This is one of the best shirts that Threadless has to offer. It's UFOs, zombies, and dinosaurs and a vampire. What sold it for me was the vampire riding the dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
So, podcast
Threadless.com, anyway,
that's your sort of thing, so...
I realized I was basically describing Buckaroo Banzai.
But
even Peter Weller's children probably think he's not cool.
Yeah.
Well, let me put this to the table. We talked a little bit about the gay panic.
Let's put
thing.
This to the panel.
To circle around to the gay panic issue, you talk about the candy bar thing where they do the gay panic. They talk about all this gay panic. It feels to me like they're echoing a scene in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. That I think worked pretty well. You know what we're talking about? The
pillows.
I don't remember
that's
that
not
scene.
Put pillows. My hand between two pillows. Those aren't pillows.
Oh.
They go nuts. They run around. They talk about wanting to watch sports. Somehow that scene comes off like two men who maybe are scared of homosexuality, and it's funny that they are scared of it.
Let me put this
why does that scene work and nothing in
let
this,
me put this,
that,
I would,
this movie
I would
works.
Say for one thing that the talent involved in that scene is...
Also,
well, you know,
William H. Macy is a talented actor. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
Let me put this out there.
Tim Allen has made good comedies.
We're all pretty liberal people at this table. However,
we're all voting for Obama.
I woke up next to either of you with my hand between your buttocks, I might be a little distressed.
But yeah,
I might overcompensate.
You would be
I
more.
Think that's like something that like anyone can relate to. There's not necessarily like some sort of inherent prejudice involved in that scene. It's more of like, this is an absurdly uncomfortable situation that we need to cover up for, rather than like at any moment in this movie they appear to have hair triggers of people thinking that they're gay.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to overreact to that. I'm saying that if you guys were thinking of placing your buttocks around my hand at any point.
Around your hand, yeah.
You're saying that it would be...
I would object to that.
It'd be very easy to laugh it off as something that would happen, and that'd be awkward is what you're saying.
Right.
Or that it's not so much the homosexual aspects of it as that kind of intimate contact out of nowhere and by surprise...
It's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable. Especially with someone who you're not romantically involved.
Whereas this movie has a scene in which...
How many fingers are we talking about? Let's keep going. Let's keep going.
4 in the stink or 5 in the stink?
If the thumb is involved, all right. Now you see we're doing it.
But what if
we've become what we love?
But what if it's 2 fingers from one hand and 3 fingers from another hand? Is that different? Better
Speaking
or worse?
Speaking of gay, though.
Wild Hogs. Oh, by the way, this is a family film. This was released as a family film. There are tons
a lot of male ass, though.
And a lot of male ass and a lot of sweat. Like, they say the word asshole probably 20 times, the word shit probably 15 times. Like,
and I can only assume that the gay panic is what makes it a family film. Like, the people in the heartland, like the dads are like, I'm going to take my kid to that Wild Hogs, because that's a movie about people who are terrified of the gays.
Look, see that up there, son? That's how you react in that situation.
Tremendous amount of classic rock in that movie, too. Whatever the boilerplate music, what are some of the titles that we heard?
Although I don't think they played Born to be Wild, did they?
To be fair, the DVD broke at the end.
That's true. They probably ended with that.
Yeah, we fuzzed out a little in the end. But,
as we were saying, we reached Wild Hogs' kill screen, and the DVD could go no further.
Mm-hmm.
No one's ever gotten that far into the film Wild Hogs.
There was Jesus, God.
What's the one? They didn't play Bad to the Bone.
On a Steel Horse I Ride, Wanted Dead or Alive by Bon Jovi. They did that one.
Pretty much any stock like rock,
Highway to Hell they did.
Any stock rock and roll song that might have any
Slow Ride.
Yeah, anything that would involve riding or
driving or biking. There's an 85% to 90% chance that it was in this movie.
Basically, the soundtrack producer for this movie had the easiest job in movie history.
They just gave it over to the Soundtrack 3000, the magical computer.
Andre 3000's son, Soundtrack 3000, who does Hollywood soundtracks.
Yeah.
Andre, can we borrow your kid for a little bit? Sure. Soundtrack, you got a summer job.
We made reference to John C. McGinley and to Gay Panic, and the thing was, early in the film...
You said it as if they were both people.
You know, Gay Panic, the popular drag queen. Yeah,
opening for Head of Lettuce, I believe.
Excellent. Yeah. But
Ed the Happy Clown. I can't make a reference to that. That's too obscure. Anyway, you were saying
Head of Lettuce was on Project Runway. That's a national show. Early in their adventures, they camp out, and William H. Macy manages to wing a flaming marshmallow into their tent.
No, Tim Allen does that. Right?
Tim Allen does that.
He pulls a marshmallow.
William H. Macy has a bag of shit that
shits in a wood. If you're wondering whether William H. Macy shits in the forest,
the answer is yes. Tim Allen pulls a marshmallow out of the fire and it's on fire, and he goes, whoa, well, this one's done, or something like that, and flings it over his shoulder. And luckily it just hits their tent and burns that to the ground, but he could have destroyed a forest.
And as I made the point, it went right through
the tent. Yeah. So I think the marshmallow was so hot.
The tent could have been made out of spun sugar, and maybe it just, you know.
I went camping literally last weekend, and I made s'mores. And when a marshmallow's on fire, you just blow that fucker out, and you eat it. It has a delicious charred exterior, and the inside is melty. You're not like, oh, well, this is ruined.
I like a golden brown marshmallow. I don't have a problem with him flinging. You know, you're out on your own. You're with the Wild Hogs. You got something on fire. You're going to throw it.
All right, but
my problem is, if you're going to throw a marshmallow that's on fire, at least you throw it so you can see the flaming trajectory of what you're doing.
It's like a mini comet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the point is, anyway, he burns delicious the tent.
But that was a funny moment, because he is sitting there talking about a fire, and then suddenly pulls a flaming marshmallow out of nowhere into camera range. So that was kind of funny that something on fire popped up out of nowhere, but,
Very few groin shots
in this movie. For Wild Hogs, it was Wild Hogs funny. It wasn't, you know.
It was Wild Hogs funny.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
That's so Raven. Like, but anyway.
It was when you're in a desert and there's like a puddle of water that someone peed in and you're like, oh, this is great. I'm dying.
The point is, like, after burning the tent down, they all, of course, sleep together on the ground. On the ground together. And
it implies
shows up.
But by the way, the tent was smaller than where they were sleeping. They would have slept together anyway in the tent, wouldn't they have? I mean,
I guess maybe there was a second tent that they forgot to put up, and that scene was cut. Maybe, and it's on the DVD now. I don't know.
The point is, John C. McGinley shows up as a cop, and you think he's going to be this like the gay hating cop.
Mm-hmm.
There's a series of wacky things that they say, very Three's Company sort of.
Oh, my jaw hurts from all the blowing I did.
Yes, he was because he was blowing on the fire, and it hurt his jaw.
And also, no one was meant to have something that big between their legs, you know, something
but it
about
turns
the motorcycle.
Out that John McGinley, after threatening them with
criminal charges.
It turns out that he,
which
is,
as far as he knew, they were guilty of.
Yeah. Turns out he's out and proud and wants to join in the orgy. So
it was a similar turn to that one episode of Studio 60 where Nate Cordry was pulled over by John Goodman as the hick sheriff, and John Goodman's like, "Now I'm going to throw you, New York boy, in jail." No, that's what you think I'm going to say. Actually, it was that same exact turn, but pulled off just as poorly. So, except in Studio 60, it was done to make a point, I guess, about
society,
anti-small town prejudice.
So the point is, even though John C. McGinley was really nice and not charging them with crimes, they all tore away on their motorcycles, terrified that the gay man might attack them.
He is a
They biked away from him because they actually, I think,
told him, they implied that they were two gay couples and that there was no room for him.
Right.
And then they got the hell out of there.
I think they implied it, though, through William H. Macy's total misunderstanding of it. Like, he's just like an innocent. His character
He's the Harpo Marx of the group.
John McGinley says five is a crowd. And then Travolta says, no, it's an odd number if you know what I mean.
Oh.
Does that mean that
the two
guys are going to pair off and be having anal sex with each other?
Or, you know, 69ing. Anything
or 69ing?
Two people
can do. Yeah. Why do you assume it's anal sex, Rich? Come on. Is this your impression of gay men?
Well, I mean,
just anal sex?
It could just
be No, that's exactly my point. I mean, you know, we could do. I don't see why one more in a reach around is going to hurt anybody.
All right. Fair enough.
By the way, I didn't want to go there. You pressed me. You pressed
but that's
me,
not the
and
scene.
I went there.
That's not the scene with the male nudity is the strange thing.
About.
There's also a scene where they go skinny dipping in a lake where you see far more of them than you want to.
Yeah, if there are any ladies out there who are real Macy
any of
fans, real
you,
William H. Macy fans.
Oh, you see
fans,
William H. Macy's butt, that's true.
You see his ass
And you're
on
tired of
occasions.
Watching the cooler over and over again. Yeah.
This is your other choice.
I don't know when that day will come.
So there's another scene of panic where they all start skinny dipping together, and a family comes up and rescinds their offer of potato salad once they realize that they're all nude.
Mm-hmm.
And then John C. McGinley shows up again.
Also nude.
Also nude. And wants to join
But what it
them.
Implies is that he was watching them from, I guess, a rock somewhere.
He's been following
nude.
Them through
I assume,
several states.
I assume he was just masturbating while watching them, and then he's like, oh, I actually need to get in there.
You need to get on the sweet action. Check out William H. Macy.
And then, of course, rule of threes in comedy, the third time something happens is the funny time. John C. McGinley never shows up again throughout the film. Two appearances, then he's done.
Oh, and we forgot, in the beginning, they all choose to throw away their cell phones.
Yes, that's in a very contrived bit of business.
Yeah, so if you were wondering, hey, this is a modern film, they seem like they're getting into a lot of shenanigans. Why don't they just call someone?
But then, even then, there's no moments where it's like, uh-oh, if we had a cell phone, everything would be okay. There are scenes that it would have been better off if they had a cell phone. Like, there's a part where they get past, they leave a gas station because John Travolta's being afraid they're being chased by the bikers whose bar he blew up by accident. They see it, they drive, they leave this gas station, and then you see the sign, last gas station for 200 miles, cut to them walking their bikes through the desert, complaining about how thirsty they are. Then all of a sudden they look.
With a vulture
following them.
Standing by.
Then they look to the side, and there's a whole town there. And that with, and like, there's a diner right there. Like, they've managed to walk 200 miles with their bikes in the same day. That, you know,
well, that introduces the third act of the film. But before we get to that, like, we want to.
But I'm just amazed at this Herculean feat of these four middle-aged men walking their bikes 200 miles in one day.
You're saying that songs should be sung of the Wild Hogs.
This is an epic feat.
Yeah,
like that. Like that's the Israelites had about the same distance to travel and it took them 40 years. That's.
Well, the Israelites.
Unfortunately, they didn't have the wild hogs to lead them.
I was trying to think of a Semitic wild hogs pun. I don't know that I can.
Well, they couldn't call themselves wild hogs because it wouldn't be kosher.
Yeah.
I was hoping it wasn't going to be that one.
Yeah, that's the only one I can think of.
So earlier in the film, before they reached this town, though, they managed to run afoul of Ray Liotta and his cronies.
I'll be right back.
I'm just getting some more water.
Ella's leaving right in the middle of the podcast, everyone.
I think he's offended because we were talking about Jews.
So Ray Liotta and his cronies.
Ray Liotta and his cronies. What happens is they go to a real biker bar, and Ray Liotta dresses them down for being suburban posers.
And we need Elliot to describe the Ray Liotta laugh. I mean, I guess we all knew this already,
this
but just it's tough to do in radio. But
it's hard because you've got to see it really. But Ray Liotta has a special laugh where he opens his mouth and doesn't move it, moves no muscles on his face, and just goes. It's just a frightening laugh because it's literally like he's just opening his mouth and then shooting cannon fire of laughs out of his face. There's no, it's not like a ha ha ha, like, it's just like propelling laughs at
him. Gun
and
laugh.
He looks so
jowlless.
Yeah,
is what it is.
Yeah,
the jaw locks like
it's
a snake shooting venom. But
yes,
it's
exactly.
Just,
he's like a ventriloquist dummy in the open position.
But also, and his face gets so intense while he's doing it, even though it's not moving, that you think he's gonna having a heart attack. You think it's Wallace Shawn in The Princess Bride laughing as he's being poisoned to death and then falls over. Like, that's what you expect. Oh, I can say one more thing about this biker bar. It's a real biker bar, real tough, full of bikers, strewn with Christmas lights around, because biker bars look basically like girls' college dorm rooms.
Mm. Yeah, but they run afoul of these guys. Ray Liotta dresses them down for being not real bikers, which, to be honest,
they are not.
Fair enough.
They are not real bikers.
Fair enough, Ray Liotta.
Guilty as charged.
And so he tricks them into a trade for a like shitty bike, like a disassembled bike. And so like they go off, the Wild Hogs go off cowed. And then John Travolta turns back. He's like, no, this will not stand.
William H. Macy, by the way, is in a sidecar.
Yeah.
And I think it's possible that there are jokes that must have been cut out with Macy in the sidecar. Why would you put Macy in the sidecar?
Yeah.
I think that's like a Hollywood saying, like, never put Macy in the sidecar unless you got a gag. But, yeah.
They've been saying that for 80 years.
Travolta goes back to the
I think
the
it was
place.
Buster Keaton who said that first.
And he clips all of their fuel lines, and Liotta runs out. He's like, oh, I'm going to get those wild hogs. Confound them. And they
I wouldn't
drive
have gotten
on.
Away with it, you two, if it weren't for you wild hogs.
And they try and get... They try and give chase.
The only time it's okay to laugh like that is when Joe Pesci has just said something. That's the only okay time, when it's right.
They try and give chase, but Liotta manages to set the gas aflame, and all of their bicycles blow up. And
Travolta, the bar. And the bar blows up, too.
Yeah, the bar. As I said at the time, that's someone's business.
Yes. Dan being a really a champion of the small business owner, really took it to heart that this roadhouse owner's livelihood had just gone up in flames.
So John Travolta feels very guilty, possibly thinking that he's murdered all of these bikers.
Well, the audience, we're not sure whether he's murdered them or not. Like, a lot of times you'll get in a funny commercial that has violence in it, something horribly violent will happen to someone. They will show the name of the product, and then immediately afterwards you will see them get up and dust themselves off. And see, it's okay that I just did something horribly violent.
You can buy my product. Don't worry.
Yeah, I'm okay. This film had John Travolta put gas all over the place. He drives off. You see them drop a cigarette. Huge explosion. Gasoline. Entire bar blows up. Travolta sees it in the rearview mirror, as do we, the audience, and it keeps following the wild hogs.
Like the end of Mad Max, basically.
He's just committed multiple murder.
At the very least, he's blown up a building, which is a crime. Say what you will about them getting put up on these bogus sodomy charges. He did just destroy private property in a really dangerous way.
Yeah.
So, but he keeps this from them. And then eventually they wind up at this town. This is where they meet.
Called Madrid.
Yeah, they meet Stephen Toblerowski, who's the sheriff. They meet the Sklar brothers, who are the deputies.
Marisa Tomei, a local diner owner.
Yeah, who William H. Macy finally has sex with. One has to imagine
it's
for
implied.
The first time in his life.
After an impromptu dance lesson that lasts 30 seconds, and he's ready.
Yeah, then he's an expert dancer, and he's ready to romance her at the chili cook-off.
By the way, there's one good line in this for Steven. What is it? I always forget, Toblerowski? Mm-hmm. His name, where he's talking about they have to go to the chili cook-off. Last year, a guy ate chili that was too hot, and his throat started bleeding. Changed his life. And that's his only explanation. Changed his life.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's Wild Hogs funny.
That's Wild Hogs. I just like any of the lines that don't make sense, you know, or they hint at a bigger story.
Do you think it's possible that they a lot of these, the montages of them riding bikes, and then they put them together in scenes and kind of said, let's let these guys improv, and maybe they'll come up with some entertaining comedy based on their characters.
You mean they came up with nothing?
And then so they were like, I guess just do the gay sketch.
Yeah.
And John Travolta came up with a character that was completely different from scene to scene. Like, as boring as all the characters were, John Travolta's character had no arc.
He had no arc, but he was also somewhat insane.
Yeah.
Like, he would get really angry for no reason.
He berated a child in the beginning.
Berated a child, yeah.
It was a joke because he was talking on a cell phone. You assumed it was a professional business entanglement.
No.
And it was a child that was raking his overlarge lawn.
That's the comic twist.
Mm-hmm. That was
where the funny comes in.
The audience grabs their belly and goes, ooh, you got me. Wild Hogs. I didn't see that coming. Right in the breadbasket.
The movie suddenly turns into like a sub Three Amigos, a.k.a. Seven Samurai style.
Or Walking Tall.
Yeah.
Or well, the Wild One.
But they come in like the
in that there's a town in all of those movies.
There's a town being terrorized by a gang, and then some out-of-towners
this time
have
the,
to come
the town
in
really wasn't being terrorized by the gang until the out-of-towners came in.
No, but there was some discussion.
It was
the town
implied.
Was initially terrorized by the Wild Hogs, as you will remember.
Yes,
it's
they,
the first stop-off for 200 miles without gas.
Excuse me, they were only terrorized because they thought that there were the Del Fuegos, which was Ray Liotta's gang. Ray
no,
Liotta's
they
gang.
Came in,
they
started
came in
drinking
started
beer,
started
and
stealing
and,
people's
yes,
beers.
But the only reason they were scared
harassing
of them
the families
is because they thought that was Del Fuegos, and then they realized, oh no, these are people who will pay for that beer.
Oh yeah. So I didn't get that. So they thought it was the Del Fuegos
yes,
first,
yeah.
And then they realized, oh wait, these guys are just fucking assholes. So it's better.
These guys are dicks who
these are unaffiliated assholes. Right.
Yeah.
But the Del Fuegos come by looking for to bruise some people.
And the Wild Hogs definitively defeat them by getting punched a lot.
They make the diner their target. They say, yeah, we're going to destroy your diner because you destroyed our clubhouse. And the Wild Hogs stand up for the diner and get punched a lot, and they keep getting back up and keep getting punched, and this goes on for what, like 4 hours?
Well, they also stand up for the larger concept of wild hogs. They're standing up for
yeah,
the hog on the back of the jacket, like, is more important than the name on the front.
It's
that's
like
really
a
what's going on
it's
there.
Like an old Marvel comic where like Thor and Hercules would be punching each other, but they'd be talking about their life philosophies at the same time. So I say thee nay, a man's freedom must be decided by his wits, not his fists. Punches Hercules. Hercules, no, it is brawn that shall win this day. You know, punches. It was kind of like that, except the Wild Hogs were doing all the talking and Ray Liotta was doing all the punching.
Yeah. Well, there was an epiphany at one point where they decided that it was in fact the biker gang that were the posers, because they didn't have jobs,
right,
and espoused the very lifestyles that they had wanted at the beginning.
This is
of
where
the movie.
We get a little fuzzy on the plot of
since the DVD
Hogs.
Was breaking
the DVD
down.
Starts breaking down. It
no, but we were clear up to that point because they decided. No, wait. The way we should settle this, because we're not posers, is through violence. That's what we should do. We should fight.
Yeah, we'll fight for real. And then they realize it's stupid to fight because these guys are losers, even though they're beating us up.
The DVD just sort of started like pixelating. It was like a psychedelic freakout in the middle of the end of Wild Hogs, which is sort of pleasant. It sort of gave it a little.
It was sort of like when that cat walks by in The Matrix and then walks by again,
yeah,
and you realize there's a serious problem. Of course, I realized
it's
that
like
early on.
When like your family's having a get together and you've got to take the train to get there, and it turns out the trains aren't running that day, and you're like, "Yay, I can stay home."
It's exactly like that.
That's what
like,
it felt
yay,
like to me.
The end of Wild Hogs. We don't have to really watch it.
But
basically,
they are saved
they get
by
punched, and they get saved by Peter Fonda.
They're saved by a ghost of biker movies past, Peter Fonda, mm-hmm, whose triumphant speech at the end we lost most of because the disc was pixelating. But it turns out he's Ray Liotta's dad. He founded the Del Fuegos, and then he left it because he would decide to be a loner.
Didn't they mention him? Wasn't there a foreshadowing earlier in
yeah,
the film?
Yeah, they mentioned
this epic
Slade
creator,
something or other. Yeah,
Dirk Thunder Boots.
The funny thing is, like, if people haven't seen Easy Rider,
Monster
Chive,
Pants,
I like
feet
to imagine yeah, that people who haven't seen Easy Rider watch the end of this
which,
movie
by which you would mean the audience of this film, because it was for children
right,
for the most part. Mm-hmm.
No, but I like to imagine those people are like, oh, it's the guy from Ghost Rider. That's what they're making reference to. That other biker film, Ghost Rider.
Oh, Peter Fonda from the famous biker movie Ghost Rider.
That's an interesting question. Is it for kids or is it for middle-aged men? You feel like there's a lot of jokes in the beginning of the film where they're trying to appeal to the middle-aged man, or the baby boomer that maybe is now taking his kids to the film.
I think it's for
It's for retarded
stupid
people. Yeah. Really stupid people who don't like jokes.
And then at the end, their wives.
I mean, what
all
this movie is really for is for overseas sales and airplane showings.
Yeah, this
you
is
know
a really great airplane movie.
This is, or it's a movie
this
that will.
Fantastic.
This movie will live on TBS and TNT for years to come, alternating with The Green Mile and The Shawshank Redemption.
And I have to say, at the very end, all the wives show up in a minivan to be like, "What have you been doing?" But I have no idea how they found them, because they threw away their cell phones and they've been driving on a cross country, like coast to coast road trip. So I have no idea. Like
they could
directly
be,
like they've gone to every town in the U.S.
They could just be big fans of the Del Fuegos, and they saw on the website that they were after the Wild Hogs.
Oh, the Del Fuegos are fighting the Wild Hogs in Madrid.
We were on delfuegos.org. It's supposed to be delfuegos.edu.
.gov.
Maybe CNN was covering the story. I don't know. Ira Glass did a piece about it on This American Life. But anyway, we should wrap
up. Yeah, we should wrap this up because you...
I've got to go. I have to get up early in the morning for my 7 a.m. flight to Santa Barbara, California.
Yeah, you...
I have no such good excuse.
I lead a glamorous life.
You've been out of town, as we said, covering the conventions. Maybe later on you'll favor us with some stories. I won't make them... You tell them
now. Oh, sure. We could do a Flophouse non-movie minute sometime. Where I can talk about working with Ian McShane. That's right, from Deadwood. Ian McShane.
You may know him as the ghost in Scoop.
the ghost in Scoop, or the evil polar bear in the Golden Compass.
Well, we'll get to that later. Actually, let's go to final judgments on this film. Was this a good, bad movie, a bad, bad movie, or a movie that you actually genuinely liked in some way? Elliot.
I'm going to say this was a bad, bad movie, not only because it wasn't funny, but because it failed at the very rudimentary tasks of giving its characters personalities and then giving them things to do. Right. It would be so easy just to have made one guy the sports nut, and one guy's the rock and roll fan, and this other guy, he loves, surfing, but instead they kind of vague, drab, middle-aged men. Felt like a Raymond Carver story in that way.
Yeah, I'm going to say...
But in a bad way.
If you have friends that enjoy, watching shitty movies, this might be a marginal good, bad movie, just because I feel like it is such a compendium of bad comedy cliches. Every bad comedy cliche you could imagine might be in a movie, most of them show up here. Not all, it's not the perfect storm of bad comedies, but it could have been written by screenwriter writing computer.
I don't think there are any fart jokes in it, are there?
Yeah,
but especially since they go to a fucking chili festival.
That is extraordinary.
What the fuck? They go to a chili festival and there aren't any farting jokes?
All right, you convinced me. I've changed. God. It's a bad, bad movie.
I don't know. I feel like it's let's take the when he gets hit in the face with a raven.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. I'm watching the film and it was one guy gets hit with a bug. Mm-hmm. Then another guy gets hit with he got hit with a bug. Other guy gets hit with a lot of bugs. I said in jest, in making fun of the funny bad movie, hey, wouldn't it be funny if he got hit in the face with a goose? All right. Now he's hit in the face with a raven, but he doesn't fall off his bike. The raven
is still alive.
There's a shot of the raven. it takes four shots and four cuts to get this piece of physical comedy across. All you need is a white blur and a poof of feathers, and then he's down. And you got a half decent. So I feel like there are some jokes in here, but it's like the when you go to the optometrician and they put the thing over your eyes and they just go better or better, better or better. And I think this is two clicks away from funny, but the funny is there.
I don't know what that means, but take it for what it is.
I'll sum it up this way. I think that for me, it was a good bad movie in that it's fun to participate in the Flophouse.
Right.
And, it's like getting a chance to meet Bruce Springsteen. If you got a chance to meet Bruce Springsteen and they said, hey, you want to come meet Bruce Springsteen? I'd say, yes, that'd be a good time. And they'd say, just come on over, and he's going to slam your hand in a desk drawer five or six times. And I'd be like, I don't know whether I would like that.
Thanks for coming over. Yeah. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah. And he's explaining.
I appreciate that you're doing this. I just like it.
Bang. Bang. And he's the boss. He's explaining to you the moment when he wrote Born to Run. And you're like, this is uncomfortable and I don't enjoy it, but this is still somehow a pleasurable experience.
To be born in the USA is really, my hand.
Bang. Bang.
For
bang,
some reason, every
bang.
Time he slams your hand, he yells Thunder Road.
I would hate it. It would really hurt my hand a lot. But at the end of the day, I would walk away saying, you know what? I just met fucking Bruce Springsteen. I met the boss. And they'd be like, why is your hand in a cast? I'll be like, I'll tell you later. That's
right.
The Flophouse.
That's pretty good. All right, I'll take that.
It was no Bratz movie. Tell you that,
yeah,
Wild
it was,
Hogs.
It was not any Bratz movie.
You guys watched the Bratz movie?
On a way.
That ended up being so. It was a terrible movie, but it ended up being so much more entertaining.
A documentary from Wisconsin about sausage preparation.
On a rating of 1 to 10.
The Bratz movie.
Bratz. This ranks 6.5.
And yet,
Bratz.
It was much easier to watch than 10,000 BC.
Oh, so much more. Don't. America, if it comes down to a choice between 10,000 BC
and Wild Hogs, I never thought I would ever say this, but choose Wild Hogs over the movie where they fight mammoths and giant birds.
So if you're in a public library in a small town in Indiana, and there's four videotapes on the shelf, you're going to want to pick Wild Hogs.
DVDs.
Probably videotapes, actually.
Yeah.
So
you can either watch Brideshead Revisited, the PBS series again, or I guess it was BBC, or you can watch Wild Hogs or 10,000 BC.
Let's move briefly to business before we do our recommendations.
Gentlemen, dividends are down this quarter.
No. I want, first of all, we talked about your day job briefly, Elliot. I want to extend congratulations to you Elliot has been hired on as a writer for The Daily Show.
Huzzah.
He had been producing there, and now...
it's basically your basic Horatio Alger story. Started as an intern, worked up to being a writer.
It really is.
Someday
though.
I'll be president. Like, president of television.
You know,
very fun time to be writing on that show, I would imagine.
I'm no, but I gotta say, it is a testament to the work ethic because no, because I'm because
I could have given up.
I'm bitter that I I'm bitter that I don't have like a good comedy writing job. But what the fuck have I ever done?
Well,
you on the other hand, like started off as like what like a PA on the show.
I was an intern at the show. Yeah, and then they hired me as a PA, and then
way all the way up to a writer,
PA to AP to segment producer.
That's
to...
genuinely admirable.
Well, thank you.
So
this is Dan's way of asking you if you can get an intern gig.
Yes, I'll see if I can get you an internship. You need to get school credit
way
for
past
it.
The point where that would be tenable. But
you'd be surprised.
Anyway,
well we'll get interns in, and it's like, hey, nice to meet you. Yeah, well, I went back to school to get my degree. I'm 35. Oh, okay. What are you studying? Not something TV production related.
Well, that's very strange.
Yeah, and anyway, but you were saying.
I was pretty much done. I was congratulating you.
Thanks.
On your
take
on
that,
your good
Stuart
work.
Wellington.
Yeah.
Manager.
He's off doing business somewhere. And look at Elliot.
I just heard he has a cool little like a role-playing store, right?
He's a strategy gamer. Speaking of gay,
here's how pathetic I am. I think that's awesome.
No, it's pretty awesome.
I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah,
he's a good man, and
he's a great guy.
I think he's
gamer.
A huge dick. I just think he has a cool job.
Oh, okay, all right. Fine.
He's a terrible human being. Don't get me wrong.
We were just looking for a reason to work this piece of information into the podcast, though, and that's that we look at you look at stats for how people come to the Flophouse website. You can like look at the stats and like what keywords get you there. And the keywords Stuart Wellington gay,
that was me,
and gay Stuart Wellington have brought...
The first one was me. I can't say for the second
someone
one.
To the site. So whoever Stuart Wellington's gay admirer is out there, we want you to contact the show.
He's gotten straight admirer letters before.
Yeah, he has gotten... Some girl is totally in love with him. So now we need...
By the way,
a guy.
That gay joke I just made, that was gay panic. It was a little bit of gay panic right there on my part.
Panic.
It backfired.
Yeah.
Tonight at Southpaw, gay panic.
Opener, Murray Hill. Anyway.
Murray Hell.
So let's go on to... what was the other thing I wanted to say?
What was your other bit of business?
The Uva Bowl contest.
It's pronounced Uva?
Yeah, it's pronounced Uva.
I didn't know that.
Is the video game director guy?
Yeah.
Uva? Really? I always said Uva.
I mean, it is German, so it makes sense that it would
I know
be
this
Uva
because
of
I he actually I was guess, on but... a screenwriting podcast I listened to. I don't know why one would want to take advice from Uva Bowl, but he was on there. So I now own Wild Hogs because our local DVD store is going out of business. And
a screenwriting podcast. Wow.
And I tried to rent this movie.
Interior podcast recording studio. Two men sit at microphones talking about screenwriting.
I tried to rent the film Wild Hogs for the purposes of making fun of it on this podcast, and I was not allowed to rent it. I could only purchase it. So for $3, I now own Wild Hogs. I don't want to keep Wild Hogs, but the winner of the Uva Bowl contest, in addition to getting the first season of Rocky and Bullwinkle on DVD, you will now get a signed by the Flophouse copy of Wild Hogs, the very copy that we used to do this podcast.
You could have sent that to the Smithsonian, to Planet Hollywood. You could have shot it into space as an artifact.
No, Elliot, no.
You could have buried it in a time capsule for future generations to discover.
I could have done all those
things. You could have, I mean, on the open market auction house, it easily would have fetched millions.
You know what you couldn't have done? Watched it again because it's defective.
Yeah, it is a defective.
It's a defective DVD. The DVD is not going to... You can't watch the end of the film.
You would have thought the only defect was that Wild Hogs was the movie that was recorded on it, but it has more than one defect.
Additional defects, yeah.
Yeah, but if you just want a memento, then enter the contest, and that will be added on to your prize. So
with no extra charge.
Let's rapidly, because Elliot...
gotta go.
Gotta get out of here. Let's talk about recommendations. Movies that we've seen recently that we actually enjoyed. Elliot, go.
I haven't gotten to see too many movies recently. I was out of town for a couple weeks, and I didn't get to really watch much. But a movie I watched before I went out of town that I enjoyed a lot was The Honeymoon Killers, which listeners to this podcast may have seen before, but I had not. In some ways, it's kind of like if John Waters had made a really creepy, dramatic film instead of a campy comedy, and not just because, well, a lot of it's because the lead female in it is very overweight, but this overweight nurse and her accented boyfriend, basically the boyfriend meets Lonely Hearts women via personal ads, then they go to the women's houses, murder them, and steal their money, and it's done in this very low-budget style that helps it a lot, but also there's a lot of really great shots in it. It's beautifully shot, and the acting in it is very, like, it reaches that really nice edge between extreme and realistic, but it was very good. I'd read a lot about it, but I'd never seen it before, but I enjoyed it greatly.
I have a lot of movies that I could recommend, but in the interest of keeping it short, I'll quickly say that The Bank Job is a good, like, sort of like B thriller, if you want to see that, of recent years. And also I watched The Naked Jungle, which was based on one of my favorite short stories as a kid, Line Engine versus the Ants, about a plantation owner who, you know, fights back against a horde of ravening ants that are threatening his plantation.
I always thought Lanigan.
Yeah, well, in the movie they pronounce it Leiningen.
I always thought it was Studs Lonigan.
I thought it was Longitude. but the movie is sort of weird because it largely dispenses with the ants and is a sort of a melodramatic romance for, I would say, a good 75 minutes of its 90-minute runtime.
But then the ants come in.
Yeah, for the last 15 minutes, oh my God, they're ants.
It's like a picnic.
But it's funny because, like,
it's terrifying.
It's like the movie picnic, but with ants at the end.
Yeah. But the other stuff is good, too, because it's got Charlton Heston acting like a dick. Like, it's not one of these movies where, like, the guy's like a gruff guy, but you can see underneath it he's really good, and you can understand why the woman is falling for him. Honestly, Charlton Heston acts like a complete tool through most of this film, and it's kind of amusing. But also, the woman that he's called down to his plantation in South America to be his mail order bride, when she arrives, she sort of lets this young native boy carry her parasol, and the head of the plantation, like Charlton Heston's number two guy, is like, oh, do you want this boy? Would you like this boy for your own? And she's like, oh, won't his parents be upset if I take him? Like, no, they'll think it's a blessing. They'll just make more. And then she takes the kid. She takes the kid with her. I don't know whether that kid's her slave now or what. But it just seems like a very strange, indication of the time that movie was made.
Did I ever tell you about the movie On Borrowed Time?
Yeah.
It sounds kind of like that. Lionel Barrymore is this guy who is very close with his grandson, and death comes and says, it's your time, you got to come now. And Lionel Barrymore's like, forget it, I'm not going to die, whatever. And then his grandson,
like Seventh Seal School, death shows up. There's a character playing death. Okay.
Exactly. And then the grandson falls out of it. Like, death tricks him into falling out of a tree, and he's on death's door. And Lionel Barrymore's like, no, no, take me. Take me. I'll go. And the movie ends with Lionel Barrymore and his grandson walking off to heaven together. And you're like, no, you're supposed to give your life to save the boy. Like, it's supposed to be an exchange. You're not supposed to die in addition to him. This is terrible.
Like a shoddy deal.
Yeah, not a great movie. Anyway.
My turn for recommendations?
Sure.
I think I'll... This is one that, again, film buffs who listen to this podcast may know it, but I'm bringing it up with the recent launch of the True Blood show on HBO. There's sort of a resurgence in the vampire genre, and it made me think... I have not seen it yet, but someone who I respect a great deal has watched the premiere and said that it was schlocky and a little bit too... Look how sensual and sexy our vampires are.
It's funny, the schlock was what I really enjoyed about it.
Oh, have you seen? I haven't seen it, so to be fair, it very well may be okay, but the aggressive marketing campaign that's been barraging me for the past 9 months has led me to...
It's definitely schlocky.
Yeah, it's led me to... It will have to be much, much better than I expect for it to impress me at this point. But anyway, I just thought, for looking back for actual really good creative vampire movies, one of the first movies that put Guillermo del Toro on the map is a movie called Cronos, which is a Spanish movie. And this is, of course, director of Pan's Labyrinth and
Hellboy.
Devil's Backbone. Well, Hellboy, sure, of course, Hellboy.
Hellboy 2.
Hellboy 2.
Blade 2.
I like Blade 2,
yeah,
actually.
Blade 2 is certainly the best of the Blades.
It is. It's the best of the Blade movies.
Mimic.
They took that movie away from him, I will say that.
Okay. That's another one of those movies that's based on a 5-page short story.
How many times have I told you people I don't want this show to be a referendum on me defending the film Mimic?
That's a fair point. You mentioned that before we started.
7 or 8 times, at least.
And someone that, Elliot, you and I have met, directed Mimic 3, so there's that.
Who directed Mimic 3?
J.T. Petty.
Oh, I forgot J.T. directed that. Yeah. That's right. Newlywed J.T. Petty.
Regardless.
Anyway, sorry.
Kronos, interesting film based on ancient medieval technology, and the vampire comes through this artifact that this grandfather finds, and not to spoil the film, but it's a very, very interesting take in which the grandfather finds himself embroiled in this situation and having to raise a very small child at the same time, and a lot of the same themes that you see in Pan's Labyrinth in terms of childhood and innocence, and also on a very low budget, very, very worth on Netflix.
All right.
If you ever saw Monster Squad and you were like, there must be a better way to make this movie.
Wait a minute. Kronos better than Monster Squad.
If you saw Monster Squad and said, I want to see Monster a grandfather Squad. Licking blood off a bathroom floor.
Monster Squad is on the shelf behind you, Elliot.
That's,
so
okay.
I don't know what that proves. But
to Werewolf's sum up, got nards.
Werewolf does have nards.
Is it Wolfman? It might be Wolfman.
Wolfman. Wolfman's got nards.
I'm the werewolf author.
Scary German guy. Anyway.
Mimic.
Let's just... You know who's gotten a psychedelic recap of what we talked about.
You know who's gotten short shrift in this podcast? The director of Mimic 2.
Hey, who's that guy?
I don't even know. Yeah. Listen, if Charles S. Dutton's not in it, I'm
call
not interested.
Call into the show. It's not a call-in show, but call in.
Call into the show that has no phone number.
Tell us who directed Mimic 2. But in the meantime, we just want to say, again, congratulations to Elliot. We miss you, Stuart. I hope you're having a good time on your business trip.
Yeah, and wherever you are.
Thank you to Rich for coming down and watching a movie that you would not have enjoyed otherwise.
I had a great time.
So, for the Flophouse, I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Elliot Kalin.
Good night.
That was Rich Duncan.
I noticed that Sarah Schaefer sang the song last time and she did it wrong.
Well, hogs can't be broken. That's what I always say.
Well, they came pre-broken. Wild hearts can't be broken. The story of a woman who did something useless and then kept doing it, even when people told her to stop.
If you like films about diving horses,
then this is the one and only film for you.
Are we on?
Yeah.
We're always on.
Sweet.